This message comes from Noom, using psychology and biology to build personal meal plans to fit your lifestyle, taking into account dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com.
Before we get into the episode, I wanted to take a minute to ask for your help. We want to hear from our listeners about what you like about Code Switch and how we could do better. You can tell us what you think by taking our survey at npr.org/codeswitchsurvey. Thank you.
What's good? You're listening to Code Switch. I'm Gene Demby. So 25 years ago, a miracle happened. It was Thanksgiving Day, 1999, and a little boy appeared off the coast of Miami, his small body bobbing up and down in the ocean. Two fishermen found him there and helped him get to the shore. He was all alone. He was dazed, but he was remarkably alive. That little boy, his name was Elian Gonzalez, and he was almost 6 years old when he showed up on the shores of Florida. He and his mother had been traveling from Cuba on their way to the United States on a boat made out of aluminum. Elian's mom and 10 others, they died during that journey. The boat's engine turned out to be faulty. But somehow, Elian survived. But if that harrowing journey were not traumatic or dramatic enough, little Elian was immediately thrust into the spotlight. His fate became the subject of this big international debate. Should he stay in the U.S. and live with his relatives in Miami? Or should he go back to Cuba to live with his father, who very much wanted him back? How people answered that question at the time, it tended to reflect a lot about their wider beliefs about the benefits of democracy, about the importance of family, about America, about Cuba, about Fidel Castro, about immigration writ large. Penny Lay Ramirez, she was 12 years old living in her home country of Cuba when this story started to unfold, and her journey to make sense of what was going on with Elian's story, it began then, and it would last for the next two decades. Her fascination has become the subject of a new podcast from Futuro Studios and Latino USA called Chess Piece, The Elian Gonzalez Story. It's a fascinating, messy, tense story with no real easy, straight answers. We're going to share the second episode of Chess Piece with you, but you can find the whole 10-part series wherever it is you get your podcasts. Until then, here's Penny Lay Ramirez.
When Elian made it to Miami, I was 12 years old, living in Cuba. My younger brother, Juan Carlos, who we call Juanqui, was 8. Juanqui, like me, remembers Elian's face was everywhere.
Yeah, of course, and they made shirts and posters and all over the school. It was the flavor of the month, you know?
Elian's story was more than just the flavor of the month, actually. It was a national cause. Before Elian was even rescued, his family in Cuba had contacted the Communist Party in his hometown, seeking help. That's how Fidel Castro found out about Elian. The Cuban government sent a message to the U.S. the day after Elian was found. Regresen al niño a su papá en Cuba. Return the boy to his father in Cuba. In the days that followed, Castro met with Elian's father and became increasingly angry.
El único que podría solicitarlo es el padre, y el padre lo está reclamando. Y lo que hace Estados Unidos es mantener secuestrado al niño.
He said the U.S. has kidnapped Elian González.
Vamos a ver si resisten. La batalla mundial de opinión no será una guerra, pero vamos a ver si resisten.
It sounded a little like a threat. But the ominous tone in Castro's voice escaped my kid brother. He was more concerned that he could not watch his regular cartoons because of the constant news about Elian.
They were giving a whole spiel of bring back Elian. At that time, I'm a kid that really didn't care about it.
I did not care about cartoons. I was just a regular nerdy preteen, dividing my time between poetry and the Spice Girls. The year before, my father had fled Cuba for Miami. He was trying to escape the poverty and instability of our country. I didn't know when I will see him again. Much of this time in my life is blurry, but there is one sharp memory. I'm in front of the U.S. headquarters in Cuba at a government-mandated protest that I was required to attend. Screaming loudly, "Regresen a Elian! Bring back Elian to Cuba!"
Cuba sí, ya aquí no.
This memory surprises me now because, frankly, I don't remember what I actually thought of Elian. Like, I don't remember actually having an opinion. And yet, here I was at this protest, screaming from the bottom of my heart. I have come to realize I was not screaming for Elian. I was screaming for my dad. Screaming in frustration that, like Elian, the same strip of ocean separated me from my father. I did not understand or really care about the political forces that had caused our separation. I only knew that I missed him, that I needed him, that I was angry that I could not be with him. And so, I screamed.
No family should have to go through what we went just because they're looking for a better future.
My brother told me this recently. I agree. But we are Cuban, and to be Cuban is so often to be separated from your family. I'm Penny Lay Ramirez, and this is Chess Piece, the Elian Gonzalez story. A production of Futuro Studios in partnership with iHeart's My Cultura podcast network.
This message comes from BetterHelp. This holiday season, do something for a special person in your life. You. Give yourself the gift of better mental health. BetterHelp Online Therapy connects you with a qualified therapist via phone, video, or live chat. It's convenient and affordable and can be done from the comfort of your own home. Having someone to talk to is truly a gift, especially during the holidays. Visit betterhelp.com/NPR to get 10% off your first month.
This message comes from NPR sponsor REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing, backpacking, and another outdoor thing that rhymes with backpacking. Visit your local REI Co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways you can opt outside.
Support for NPR comes from Google. This year, Google is celebrating the breakout searches of 2024 that captured the world's attention and shaped our year in ways we never saw coming. Watch the film at g.co/yearinsearch. Google, search on.
On December 6, 1999, Elian Gonzalez celebrated his sixth birthday in Miami. It was just a week and a half after he had been rescued from the sea. He had been staying with distant relatives on his dad's side. His great-uncle, Lázaro González, and Lázaro's 21-year-old daughter, Marie-Lacis.
How did he survive by himself when he's only five? And the only thing I could possibly say is that it's just a miracle.
People said she became like a mother figure for Elian. She cared for him, making him chocolate milk, something that was a luxury in Cuba and that Elian had quickly come to love. One journalist reported that Marie-Lacis would say to Elian, "Mira, Eliancito, your grandmothers cannot make you this in Cuba."
I just want him to be wherever he wants to be, comfortable.
Marie-Lacis quickly became the family spokesperson. Unlike her father, she spoke English well because she had been raised in the U.S. She was young, passionate about Elian, and comfortable in front of the cameras.
And I asked him, "Do you want to go back? I mean, you know, or you want to stay here?" And he said, "I don't want to go back."
She and her father, Lázaro, believed Elian's mother died trying to give him safety and freedom in the U.S., and they were not alone. Cuban Americans would show up at their house demanding the U.S. government let Elian stay in the U.S. People would say it would be a shame to send the boy back to communism and hunger in Cuba. At his birthday at a local park, Elian was given many gifts and a huge birthday cake. But that wasn't Elian's only birthday party. In Cuba, his school organized a celebration in his absence. with a special guest, Fidel Castro himself, stopped by. He wore his typical olive green military uniform. Elian's father, Juan Miguel, spoke to his son by phone that day to wish him a happy birthday. And they spoke as if Elian will be back in Cuba soon.
Luego te cuento la fiestecita de la escuela. Hey, Viti, tírame a besito. Cuídate.
There were protests in Havana marking the week of Elian's birthday. Cubans chanted, "Down with imperialism! Socialism or death!" But the protests in Cuba did not change Elian's status in the US. His future was still in limbo. His Miami relatives had begun the process to file for asylum for Elian. At the time, Cubans were guaranteed entry to the U.S. if they made it to the U.S. soil. But Elian didn't technically meet these requirements.
Because he was rescued at sea and never made it to the shoreline, he was a wetfoot Cuban national.
This is Bernie Perlmutter, professor of law at the University of Miami. He's referring to an unusual American policy at the time known as pies secos, pies mojados, or wet foot, dry foot. It allowed any Cuban to legally stay in the U.S. as long as they made it to the American shore after crossing the ocean from Cuba, literally stepping on dry land. That's the dry foot. But Cubans who were captured or rescued at sea by the Coast Guard, they were not permitted entry to the United States. That's the wet foot.
The federal government had taken legal custody of Elian. As I said, he didn't reach the shore, so he did not have the benefit of dry feet landing on the beaches of Florida.
So Elian's status under immigration law was not certain. And another immigration policy in the U.S. at that time said that only a parent could apply for asylum for their child. So to immigration officials, Elian's Miami relatives didn't have the authority to decide the boy's fate.
I'm not sure I understand what their rights are. These were distant relatives.
This is Jim Goldman, former special agent with U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Services, or INS. We should say, in unusual circumstances, the law does allow the government to assign a guardian to an unaccompanied child, even if they are distant relatives or not relatives. But in this case, the government was insistent that there was no need to, since Elian's father wanted him back.
I think the biological father has more right to make decisions for his child, who at the time was, you know, 5 and 6 years old, more so than anybody.
Jim thinks this case should have been open and shut, but
it became a hot topic because I think the system allowed for it to become a hot topic.
He's right.
Tensions between the United States and Cuba get hotter every day. 6-year-old Cuban refugee Elian Gonzalez remains in this country.
The American media system jumped on Elian's story.
Cuban men, women, and children protested on the streets of Havana by the thousands last night. It was the largest turnout so far and the third night of protest orchestrated by Fidel Castro.
It became the biggest story in the country at a time when networks competed for wall-to-wall news coverage.
It happens at the same time that we have the modern media machine being created, the 24-hour news cycle, the dying of network news, the expansion of cable news, the need for content.
Go back and look at some of the news archives, and it does start to feel at times like Elian was treated like content. There were cameras always stuck in Elian outside the Miami home. Reporters trying to catch a look of him playing ball, being a little boy.
Relatives of Elian Gonzalez say they saw a different side of the 6-year-old, a boy simply filled with joy and happiness.
Reporters tried to capture every detail of Elian's introduction to American culture, like when he went to Disney World for the first time, where he got a personal hug and a baseball hat autographed por nada más y nada menos que Mickey Mouse himself.
But Elian showed some lingering signs of his Thanksgiving ordeal and rescue at sea when he went on the It's a Small World water ride.
And the interview request kept coming. Diane Sawyer had a play date with Lillian on camera.
It was probably the biggest media item in the United States, if not the world, at the time.
You would go to a party, you would go to a restaurant, you would see your family. The talk, the main subject was Elian. You know, what's going to happen to that boy?
Alina Mayoase is a television news pro, a seasoned news anchor who covered Miami's biggest stories for decades. She says nothing at the time could compare to the appeal of Elian's story. It was unprecedented.
It was our headline story practically every day. It was before Elian and after Elian. It definitely marked a line in the story and the history of the Cuban exile in the United States, especially in Miami.
But in Cuba, the U.S. media frenzy seemed to make Fidel Castro even more upset. And soon, Castro will send another stern message. Return the boy in 72 hours.
This message comes from Progressive Insurance. You call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. Tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options within your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This message comes from Midi Health. Women in midlife face a healthcare desert, but Midi is here to fill the gap, offering expert care for perimenopause and menopause covered by insurance. Hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, weight gain, and moodiness don't have to be accepted as just another part of aging. MIDI clinicians understand how these symptoms can connect to menopause and prescribe a wide range of solutions. Book your visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com. This message comes from MIDI Health. Women in midlife face a healthcare desert, but MIDI is here to fill the gap, offering expert care for perimenopause and menopause covered by insurance. Hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, weight gain, and moodiness don't have to be accepted as just another part of aging. MIDI clinicians understand how these symptoms can connect to menopause and prescribe a wide range of solutions. Book your visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
Fidel's message to the U.S. was clear. Return the boy in 3 days. So that the pain, suffering, and trauma of that boy and his family does not go a minute longer, he said. And his words weren't the only ominous move. Castro stationed several dozen Cuban soldiers outside of the U.S. government interest section office in Havana. This is the headquarters where I remember attending government-sponsored protests for Elian. I remember the tension in the air, the vague sense that there was something big at stake here, something with a lot of baggage. To understand why Elian's case became such a big deal, you have to understand the complicated relationship between Cuba and the United States. Let's start in the early 50s. At this time, Cuba was ruled by Fulgencio Batista, who was once elected, but whose government had become essentially a military dictatorship.
6 years of surface prosperity and government corruption, of repression and police brutality, bred explosive discontent.
Batista was friendly to U.S. interests, allowing American companies like Coca-Cola and United Fruit to own a giant amount of Cuban land. Workers struggled to survive on low wages and oppressive conditions. This inequality ripened the country for the ideals of Fidel Castro's revolution.
Cuba's Fidel Castro emerged triumphant after 2 years of guerrilla warfare against the Batista regime. The revolution that began with Castro a fugitive ended with the flight of dictator Fulgencio Batista and the entry into Havana of rebel forces to be acclaimed by the city.
He and his fighters, including a young Argentinian doctor named Ernesto Che Guevara, eventually overthrew Batista and his government. Castro and his men were the underdogs. The uprising had begun with just 18 men in the mountains of La Sierra Maestra, and it had spread to the whole island. At first, the U.S. was not alarmed.
Now, when Fidel Castro's fighting to depose Batista, he's not calling himself communist. Many of the people who were in his movement, which was called the 26th of July movement, were young people who were ardently anti-communist.
This is Ada Ferrer, the Cuban-American history professor at Princeton you heard from in episode one.
But they believed in deposing Batista. They believed in acting against government corruption.
By 1960, the new government approved laws that banned all foreign ownership of Cuban land, banishing American companies from the island and nationalizing their businesses. His government also confiscated the land of Cubans who held more than 1,000 acres. Even Castro's own mother was apparently outraged that her son had confiscated their family estate. Castro redistributed this land to workers or state communes.
They start enacting social reforms like the urban reform, cutting rents. And with all these laws that they're passing, they're getting enormous amounts of support.
Some of that support came from my own grandparents, who got the chance to buy for almost nothing the apartment that they were renting before the revolution. It was the same apartment where I was raised with my mother 30 years after that. Not everyone felt like my grandparents.
Obviously, the people whose land is being taken away are not necessarily going to support.
But Castro was well-liked in Cuba, not just by my grandparents, but by many other Cubans.
Said that your policies in Cuba, Dr. Castro, are leading to conditions of great economic difficulty. Is this so?
Everybody working. Everybody happy.
In this 1961 BBC interview, Castro is young, smiling, easygoing. The journalist wrote that Castro charmed and impressed many reporters. When Castro came to power, he promised democratic elections would come as soon as the new government stabilized. But by the early 60s, that hadn't happened. The Cubans who left for the United States after Castro had taken their land saw Castro not for a revolutionary, but a despot.
Some people say, some of your Cuban enemies say...
Who says that? Yes.
People in Miami, Americans, say that you started a revolution to bring in democracy, and you have not done so.
In this part of the video, when the reporter mentions Cubans in Miami, Castro gives a sonrisita. He smirks a little.
Do you believe that there is not democracy here?
I'm asking you a question.
That in the United States, the most free man you can find in all America is the Cuban man.
Ada says that in a survey from February of 1959, about 91% of the respondents said that the new government was doing everything perfectly well. But Washington didn't feel this way. Here is Ada again.
The president and senators and congressmen were saying, what is Cuba doing? It's turning communist.
By 1962, the U.S. had cut diplomatic ties with Cuba and declared an embargo, forbidding American trade with Cuba, hoping to create shortages and hunger on the island to destabilize Castro's new government. By this time, Castro had been turning to the Soviet Union for help and trade.
There is a limit to what the United States and self-respect can endure. That limit has now been reached.
The CIA also secretly trained some 1,400 Cubans who had left for the U.S. to invade Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, La Bahía de Cochinos, believing the attack could kickstart an uprising against Castro. But the attempted invasion failed miserably. I remember learning in our history classes in Cuba about these early days of Castro's rule, how he created new systems, free health care and free education, improving the quality of life for ordinary Cubans. I remember some people in Cuba saying that, yes, their life improved at the beginning, and they supported Castro, pretty convinced that great years were ahead. But what I didn't learn in school was that from the very beginning, the censoring and self-censoring started. And Cuba quickly became a place with almost no freedom of expression. Under this new regime, dissidents were often imprisoned. And then things got worse.
It's a period that follows the fall of the Soviet Union and state socialism in Eastern Europe. And the Cuban economy just tanked almost from one day to the next. There was the joke of, you know, Cuba, but it wasn't really a joke. You know, Cuba just has three problems, you know, el desayuno, el almuerzo y la comida, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And everywhere I went, the constant refrain was, no es fácil, everyone had to resolver e inventar. And it was just this constant struggle to live and to survive.
Over the decades, waves of Cubans left the island for the U.S. in flights and boats. There were the 14,000 children who were put on planes to Miami, in fear that they will be taken away from their families and put in communist indoctrination camps. That never happened, by the way.
Then the next wave was 1980 and the Mariel boat lift, in which 125,000 people came in the space of about, you know, 5 months, even less.
The president has literally opened the floodgates, placing no limitations on the number of Cubans entering the United States.
A decade after Mariel, with the fall of the Soviet Union, Cuba entered the years of severe scarcity that I remember from my childhood. The Cuban government named it the special period, or El Periodo Especial.
Then there was the rafter crisis in 94, which I think was about 35,000 people in the space of a few months. But in all those years, there were people leaving.
Most of the time, families could not leave Cuba together. They would decide who had a better chance to leave, save, send money, and work hard to help the rest of the family on the island. There are many families like mine and Elian's, where a parent or a child comes without the rest of their family.
Family separation is, you know, was a part of the story of the Cuban Revolution from the very beginning.
Family separation has become such a part of the Cuban cultural DNA that it's actually pretty difficult to meet a Cuban who has not been touched by it. And who you blame for that separation depends on what side of the small strip of ocean between Cuba and Florida you are on.
This message comes from Noom, using psychology and biology to build personal meal plans to fit your lifestyle. Taking into account dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs with daily lessons that are personalized to you and your goals. Noom's flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection to help you build new habits for a healthier lifestyle. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com.
Elian's story flooded every corner of life in Cuba. I remember not just attending, but watching the protests in Havana demanding Elian be brought home. So does Harold Cárdenas, Cuban journalist and political analyst.
People in Havana had to rally all the time. And it's impressive when you look at the images of the Malecón in Havana next to the sea, full of probably millions of Cubans. That is an impressive thing. That showed the capacity that the Cuban government had back then to rally people and to bring them together for a cause. I am sure that many of them were strongly encouraged in their jobs to join those rallies, but others were going because they really believe in it.
I felt this too. Sure, there were people there because the protests were mandated. But I also saw people who were truly calling for his return, outraged that the boy was being kept from his father.
Obviously, at that age, it's hard to distinguish between the real fight of a kid that deserves to be with his father and the propaganda, and how the governments also use people, citizens, for propaganda purposes. So as a child, it was hard to distinguish the propaganda on both sides.
In Cuba, I remember hearing a lot about how Elian's father had never agreed that Elian could be taken to the United States, how the U.S. was keeping a boy away from their rightful parent, another example of the evil U.S. empire. But for Cubans in Florida, this case was about freedom and saving a boy from oppression.
Many of the people, the Cuban Americans in Miami, identified with the mother and her motivations for doing what she did, and the fact that she lost her life in trying to do this.
This is former Assistant Secretary of State Pete Romero. But this idea that Elian's mother had died trying to reach freedom for her son is not as black and white. There is some evidence that Elian's mother was going to the United States not for freedom, but to follow her boyfriend.
They truly were the Cuban Romeo and Juliet.
While she was reporting the story, journalist Ann Luis Bardak saw a 5-page love letter between the couple. And she and others are convinced that love was the real motive.
The reason the mother was on the boat was because of her great love for Rafa Munerum. If Rafa had said, we're going to Iceland or we're going to Colombia, I think she would have gone with him.
Regardless of why she got on the boat, what you should know is people either identified with Elian's mom and the U.S. or Elian's dad and Cuba.
Everybody can understand, you know, a child who's a Cuban child taken away from, you know, the bosom of the motherland and all of that stuff. And, you know, we want him back. And, you know, I mean, it was great for propaganda.
I see how Elian was used by both sides to bolster ideology. But mostly, when I see Elian, I see us, Cubans, a people who have experienced family separation over 7 decades. I see my family. My brother Juanqui, who now lives in Miami and works as a SWAT paramedic and firefighter.
Some people thought that you looked like Elian yourself.
Well, yeah, that was my nickname on Fire Academy when I was 18. Well, my English still pretty messed up, but back then it was pretty bad. And that was my nickname on Fire Academy, Elian Gonzalez. So kind of like the little Cuban refugee, you know?
You were the Cuban refugee, Italian.
The little Cuban refugee, so they started calling me Elian.
It is true. My brother does look like Elian. Maybe that's why it's been easier for me to imagine Elian not as a headline, not as a piece of geopolitics or history, or even as propaganda. No, I see Elian as someone who once was a boy in a new and unknown country without his mom or his dad. And I know the hole that creates in your heart to be separated from a parent. Forces greater than you keeping you from them. Countries and their policies, politicians and their aims, reporters and their deadlines. That's all in the periphery. At the center, at the heart of Elian's journey, is that he was a boy who longed for his parents, like I once did. Next time on Chess Piece, Miami Cubans and Elian's relatives start getting angry.
Elian comes, Fidel hasn't gone down. Everybody's not happy about that. And by God, Fidel's not going to get this trophy.
And the battle for Elian starts breaking up a family. Chess Piece, the Elian Gonzalez story, is a production of Futura Studios in partnership with iHeart's My Cultura podcast network. This show is written and reported by me, Penilei Ramirez, with Maria Garcia, Nicole Rothwell, and Tasha Sandoval. Our editor is Maria Garcia. Additional editing by Marlon Bishop. Our senior producer is Nicole Rothwell. Our associate producers are Tasha Sandoval and Elizabeth Lowenthal Torres. Sound design by Jacob Rossetti. And our intern is Evelyn Fajardo Alvarez. Our senior production manager is Jessica Ellis, with production support from Nancy Trujillo and Francis Poon. Mixing by Stephanie Leveau, Julia Caruso, and JJ Kerubin. Fact checking by Nidia Bautista. Scoring and musical curation by Jacob Rossetti and Stephanie Leveau. End credits music from Los Acheros. Our executive producers are Marlon Bishop and Maria Garcia. Legal review by Neil Rossini. This episode was recorded in part at Dinamica Studio in Mexico City. Futuro Media was founded by Maria Hinojosa. For more podcasts, listen to the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. I'm Penilei Ramirez. See you in the next episode. Nos vemos en el siguiente episodio.
B.A. Parker, before we wrap up, the end of another year is coming up, and our team is looking back at all the deep reporting and compelling stories and conversations about race that we've been able to bring you in 2024 because of your support. We unpacked tropes and conspiracy theories. We brought you the story of America's oldest drag king. And we asked complicated questions like, whether bike lanes cause gentrification, and how to be a better tourist. And it's all because listeners like you step up to support our work, either by giving to your local station or by joining NPR Plus. NPR Plus has grown a lot this year, and we want to say an extra special thank you to those supporters right now. You know who you are, and we see you. If you don't know what I'm talking about, NPR Plus is a sweet way to support the independent public media you rely on from NPR. When you sign up for a simple recurring donation, you support our mission of creating a more informed public and get special perks from more than 25 NPR podcasts, like sponsor-free listening, bonus episodes, and even exclusive and discounted items from the NPR Shop and the NPR Wine Club. When you donate today, you join a community of supporters that's deeply curious about the world and eager to challenge assumptions. Join us on the Plus side today at plus.npr.org. Thanks.
This message comes from GiveWell. GiveWell provides rigorous, transparent research about the best giving opportunities so that donors can make informed decisions about high-impact giving. To learn more, go to givewell.org and pick podcast and enter NPR at checkout. This message is brought to you by Lisa in collaboration with West Elm. Discover the new natural hybrid mattress, expertly crafted from natural latex and certified safe foams, designed with your health and the planet in mind. Visit leesa.com to learn more. This message comes from Total Wine & More. Discover a new favorite Chardonnay, sparkling wine, or gin, and you'll discover something special. Total Wine & More. Love what you find. Drink responsibly. B21.